listener production.
Just before we get rolling, in regards to this episode, there is discussions around mental health and sensitive conversations around suicide. So have a listen yourself, potentially before you get your kids to listen to it. And most importantly, if you or someone close to you needs any help, please reach out to someone or get in touch with the professionals at Beyond Blue.
Okay, are you recording?
G'day, rock stars. You are listening to episode 166 of the Howie Games Part A featuring Dual Code International, Matt Rogers.
Rogers! Rogers! He's away! They won't get him! He's inside the 20! Matty Rogers! He puts the seal on a marvellous day for Andrew Ellinghausen and the Cronulla Sharks.
Now, Matt was what I would call a bums-on-seats style of athlete. You would pay to watch him play. He brought people to both league as an entertaining ball-running winger during his 200 first-grade games, plus his State of Origin and Kangaroos work, as well as his union career, where he lit the whole show up big time in his 45 tests for the Wallabies. The man had sizzle, and you know how we feel on this show about a bit of sizzle.
So you search and try to find, but you don't know where to go. So many thoughts flood through your mind. You're confused and want to know. Mystery, what is to be? So much more than meets the eye. Listen to me, time is your key. You will find out by and by.
This episode comes on the back of the release of Matt's engrossing new book, Matt Rogers, A Father's Son, Family, Football and Forgiveness, published by Simon & Schuster. It is a tale of humanity as much as it is about sport. Read it. It is a cracker. It is heart-wrenching at times, though it can be a difficult read. The book expands on the themes that Matt chats about in this episode, as well as many others that we do not cover. Matt's father, Steve, was a legend of the club Matt went on to represent, the Cronulla Sharks. Matt talks about the complexities of this relationship with his father, how it drove him, how at times it hurt him, the good and the bad of a pro athlete's life, and talks about lots of love, which we also like on this show.
So many lost and left behind, and no one seemed to care. Those who should seems like they're blind, pretending they're not there. Can't they see they hold the key? Could make things better if they try. Oh my Jaja, tell me why won't they open up their eyes?
I'd actually never met Matt prior to this recording. I hope I get to in the future because he seems like a really wise soul. It was recorded with Matt outside on North Stradbroke Island, hence you'll hear the birds in the background. Big thanks to Anna O'Grady from Simon & Schuster for making this happen. Again, the book is called Matt Rogers, A Father's Son. Enjoy the story of a bloke who tried harder than everyone else, Matthew Steve Rogers.
So when you search and then you find and know just where to go and thoughts that once used to cloud your mind, you see clearly and now you know. Mystery, what is to be revealed in King Selassie. Come on children, trot with me, we want to reach Mount Zion.
Well, welcome to the Howie Games, a man that was a sporting star across two codes, rugby league and rugby union, but more than that, he has now brought out a book, Matt Rogers, A Father's Son, Family, Football and Forgiveness, which we'll get to. You need to read this book whether you're into sport or not. But you're dialing in, Matty. We haven't met before, but you're showing off because you're dialing in from a brewery on Stradbroke Island, and that's probably the best place on the planet.
Well, it is beautiful here, I got to tell you. It's not open yet. It opens in a couple of weeks.
But, right.
They've been nice enough to let us film some stuff in their premises, and I look forward to coming back when it's opening and sampling some of their finest.
I had the pleasure for the first time of North Stratty maybe 2 years ago, just prior to COVID with my family, and the waves were pumping, there was fish everywhere. Is there any waves there today or is it flat?
It's a little flat, but it's beautiful, mate. Like, we only live an hour and a half down the road, so we come up here a bit. It's just a lovely part of the world to escape, and, mate, you literally could be anywhere in the world, you know, coming here. It's like you're in another country or removed from the hustle and bustle, mate. It's a lovely spot to unwind, as you know.
You grew up surfing. Do you still surf now?
I haven't for a long time.
Oh.
Broke. Well, I had some really bad rib cartilage damage. through my career, and when I finished playing football, I lost a heap of weight, so my ribs sort of like became sort of protruding a bit where the rib cartilage had sort of torn, and I just can't, like, it literally is excruciating to lay on a surfboard, so it's not ideal. But yeah, I miss it.
Do you need to bulk up there for? Do you have to put your nose in the trough and put on some kilos before you can surf, which for the most of it's the opposite?
Maybe. Well sometimes I do say I haven't surfed for a long time traditionally, but I do jump on the back of a jet ski from time to time and do some step offs with some mates up at South Stratty. So it's a fun way to surf and a lot less strenuous on the old body.
My word. Mate, there's so much to talk to you about. Congratulations on the book. I read it over the weekend. Obviously, in this job, I read a lot of sports books, but this is so much more than a sports book. It's a cracking read. What was it like? We haven't met each other before, so there's some pretty in-depth topics here to cover. What was it like bearing your soul in print as you have? And as I said again, mate, congratulations. It's a fantastic read.
Oh, I appreciate it, Howie. It was tough, I'm not going to lie. My publisher's offered a ghostwriter, and my wife wrote a book about our son Max, who's autistic, years ago, and she wrote it, and it was a great book, and she put her heart and soul into that, and I just saw the process of her going through that, and as hard as it was for her, I think it helped the process so much, and she really sort of pushed me to write it myself, along with David, my agent, and I'm glad I did. You know, after the first month, I've got to say though, I thought, what have I got myself into here? Like, this is hard work, and mate, I'm missing fingers, so the old two finger typing is all I've got. So, mate, after a month, I was thinking, what have I got myself into? And then I went through a real phase of like really loving the process of it and reliving a lot of, you know, fun parts of my life, and then I got into the pretty heavy stuff, and I have to say I almost hung up the typewriter. I really didn't want to keep going, and spoke to my publishers and sort of like didn't want to keep writing, and they said just take a break, you know, for a while and just see how you feel. And it was really when I got into the stuff surrounding my dad and his death, and I just having to write it and then rewrite it and then, you know, relive it and then speak to family members and rewrite it again based on some things that I'd sort of missed or discovered, and I just found it pretty unbearable, to be honest, at the time. And I ended up sort of agreeing to have a ghostwriter write the rest of the book for me, and then without even speaking to my publishers, I just started writing again. I thought, I can't have this stuff written by someone else. This is my life and the stuff that I went through. And I'm glad I did. You know, the finished product now I'm stoked with. And yeah, it was a journey though, I've got to tell you. Like, I really went through a stage in my, up until writing the book, where I sort of despised my childhood a bit. I just found myself constantly chasing something that I just wasn't able to attain. And reading and writing the book sort of allowed me to reassess that, and it helped me understand that challenge or that striving that I was going after sort of made me the person I am. And it sort of made me look back and think, wow, no, my childhood was good. It made me the person I am today, and it made me not want to quit. And you know, if I've got a goal, I'll go after it. And I think if I'd just been handed or got the things I was chasing so easily as a child, then maybe I wouldn't have been the person I am today. So it was a real journey, I've got to tell you. A lot of ups and downs.
It's a wonderfully in-depth answer, and it shows how much fun it's going to be having a chat with you about this. What were you trying to attain? When you've had a chance to reflect and you talked about your childhood and wanting to attain something, what was it?
I was trying to be the best at what I was doing, which was playing football. But what I was trying to attain, I was chasing down my dad. And my dad, like, I was comparing myself to him, you know, and I wanted his approval and his... I wanted so desperately for him to tell me he was proud of me and, you know, tell me that I'm doing great. And, you know, men of that build they don't say that a lot. And he never said it, to be honest. I knew he did. I know he was proud of me, and I know he did love me. But, you know, I was comparing myself to not just any person. He was like the you know, he was probably one of the premier athletes in the country, you know, playing for Australia and playing for New South Wales. And so it probably wasn't realistic, you know, as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, comparing myself to my dad and trying to beat him in everything that I did. And, you know, and he would just beat me in everything and just not laugh about it, but he just would never let me beat him in anything. And I hated it. And I remember crying to mum about it, mum speaking to dad, and then dad just getting worse. Like, that's like, oh, you want to win to your mum about it? You know, like, you're not going to win until you deserve it. You know what I mean? And it hardened me, I guess. Gave me an edge.
So you're a father of four, yeah?
Four.
Okay. So you've achieved, which we'll get to, and we'll get back to your childhood and those fingers you showed me, because it did make me chuckle how you lost them. We'll hold that thought. So how have you approached that love and pride in showing it to your own children when, as you said, fathers of your father's generation, my father's generation, they probably don't enunciate that well, but it gave you the drive in many ways to be so successful. So how have you balanced it up with your own kids?
That's not been without its challenges, Howie, I've got to tell you, because I've always been really loving and caring to my kids, but I've also got that edge to me that, like I want my kids to be perfect. Not perfect, but I want them to do well in whatever it is they're doing.
Give their best.
So unfortunately, like, you know, I probably focus a little bit too much on what they haven't done than what they have done. So I'm trying to sort of to balance that out. But at the same time, you know, I look at my childhood and what it did for me. I don't want my kids to just have an easy ride. I don't want to give them everything where, you know, life's that easy, and then they get into the real world, and you know as well as I do, like life is a competition in everything.
It is.
You know, like it's not just sport, it's in the workplace, it's in everything that you do. I want my kids to strive to be the best version of them, not compare themselves to other people. And I'm just trying to find that balance between how much do I push and how much do I, you know, just cradle those kids and just tell them that they're doing all right. You know, so it's, you know, I definitely don't want my kids to think life's going to be easy for them, because it's not. And I want them to understand that there's struggle and there's challenges that you're going to face, and, you know, they're going to be the making of you.
It's a theme that's come up a few times on this podcast, Matty, and I always leave it to the guest. And I've only offered my opinion on 160-odd shows really about this topic, about how in the way I see my kids educated, the old everybody gets a ribbon and it's a pat on the back and well done. And I say that with the greatest possible respect to the teachers that have to do this hard job with our kids every day. And the teachers come with feedback and they say, you know what, sometimes we want to be harder with the kids in that respect, but it's often the parents that get stuck into us if our child's come sixth and they don't get a pat on the back. So it's a difficult one for the educator. So I think it does start back at the home, doesn't it? But like you say, it's a juggle, because, you know, it's the start of the cricket season. You want to buy your young bloke a new cricket bat because you can, but sometimes maybe he needs to understand what the value of that cricket bat is.
Yeah, I agree. And look, in all honesty, I think the nature of that every child gets a prize has diluted the depth at the top level in all our sports.
No doubt.
You know, we're always going to have the elite level, but it's that level under that there's no real fight there.
Mm.
You know, like it's, you know, I see it in every sport now. And I think our national teams suffer because of it. I think we've lost that mongrel, you know, that Australia was so renowned for. I really feel like that there are aspects at the elite level of sport that have it, like the really elite, you know, the David Warners of the world,
yes,
the, you know, the these sort of guys. But then there's, you know, that next level down, I think we're missing it. And unless you have that unique mindset, there's generally no one else pushing you that's got it behind you. So, you know, you're right. You know, I'm in the side. I'm good.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, there's probably, you could probably talk about it for hours, but Yeah, I feel like that was instilled in me, that you fight for everything and nothing's going to get handed for you. And if you miss out, then, my dad used to say something to me all the time, when things were bad, just find a way. If I wasn't doing good, I'm doing my best. Well, your best isn't good enough. So go away and find a way to get better. Find a way.
As opposed to being told, no, that's okay. You've that's done pretty right. well there.
You did your best.
Yeah, on you go.
Sometimes, and I think, in professional sport, as we know, there's no moral victories. You either win or you lose. And I hate the fact I hate the thought of the fact that anybody at a professional level would be content with, oh, we did well. No, you lost.
Yeah.
Like, I hate that. I can't wrap my head around it. And I feel like, as a country, we may be getting to that point, and it worries me, particularly for our elite sporting teams.
And I think, I'll get off this topic, but I think the first time you come out of school and you apply for a uni position, it's a competition. You either win or you lose. You get in or you don't get in. You go for that first job. You win or you lose. You talked about your dad and your childhood. I loved in the book of Father Son your description of your first game. I think it was a rugby league, and you thought you were doing a magnificent job out in the field, taking blokes down as a 4 year old. Were you?
I was four. Yeah, 1980. Yeah. Back in the day when there was no mini league, it was full field, full side. The ball was as big as me, basically. But I do remember. My dad just. I just remember him saying it to me clear as day. And I was a little robust kid, Like, when I was a kid, they used to call me Tank because I was this little stocky, chubby kid, and I used to run hard. So Mum nicknamed me Tank and everybody else followed. So even my friends from back in those days still call me Tank. But, I just remember my dad saying to me before the game, just tackle the man with the ball, And I was, amped up, I'm fired up, four-year-old. Playing with six-year-olds and they're bigger than me, something I'm just going to rip in. And, I got in the dummy half. I still remember it. Passed the ball to my teammate next to me, and I just ran straight after him. I hit him right on the side, legs tackled, took him down, looked over to Dad, big grin. I was proud as punch, thinking I got him. And Dad's just, head in hand, shaking his head. And I'm thinking, have I done the wrong thing here? I remember sliding down this kid's legs and squeezing his knees together. I must have been 10. I looked over again, and Dad's just still shaking his head. He came over at half time and goes, mate, I meant the man with the ball in the other coloured jersey. I'm like, oh, okay.
So you were just piling into your own teammates.
Not the most gratuitous start to my rugby league career. It's not how it starts, it's how it finishes.
No, exactly right. For those that aren't aware, I'm not massively across rugby league. But I've got an understanding of the game, but I probably didn't have an understanding of your father's position in the game. Tell me a little bit about your father and what he achieved, because you obviously went and played in for the Sharks in the end, for Cronulla, and he was a legend of the football club.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he's, touted as being one of, if not the greatest Shark of all time, and Cronulla Shark, that is. And, through my childhood, he was the captain of Cronulla. He played captain to Australia.
Along the line to Fulton, not a Rogers. Rogers with that incisive pace of his, throws the dummy, and he's accelerated himself right into the clear. Oh, blimey, he's gapped them completely. This is a magnificent run by Rogers, and goes right underneath the post. That was a run from his own side of halfway.
Played in the first State of Origin, the first finished State of Origins. Unfortunately, had a really rough end of his career, broke his jaw and then broke his leg, and back-to-back, first game back from his broken jaw, broke his leg really badly, and they was playing in England, and they shortened his leg by 3/4 of an inch when they fixed it, so when he came home, they had to re-break it and reset it, and that's sort of, ended his career, probably a few years prematurely, but I'll say that... It was so different back then to the way my career played out in relation to having a father in that position. He was so big in our local area that, anywhere we went, people were just mobbing, and we'd sort of lose our dad a bit, But I was so proud of that everybody knew who he was and stuff, and different to today, whereas, if you... if you're a Matt Rogers fan, you probably follow me on Instagram, you probably follow me on Facebook, you probably see it. So you almost feel like you know me.
Yes.
Whereas back in those days, nobody, if you saw a football star, it was like, wow, that, it was a big deal. You know, like you either saw him on TV or if you went to a game. And if you saw him out in the wild, it was like pretty crazy, you know. So,
What was it like going up through the... I remember reading a couple of years ago, Matt, about Sachin Tendulkar's son getting into cricket, and it was like, Heavens above. What was it like for you as you sort of through those primary school, early high school years? Because I've no doubt when you were starting to make your own way, because I see my son do it here. Oh, we're playing such and such in the under-12s and, you know, his dad's this. I'm sure they were saying, oh, watch out for whatever because that's buddy Stevie Rogers' son.
Yeah, it's weird because I always, you know, every time I went and played and I started to sort of make some progress, and you would hear the whispers behind you or whatever, and people knew. I sort of really thrived on it. Like, I loved it. I thought, I'm going to show you. Yeah, I am his son, and I'm going to show you. And that comes back to that, me trying to be dad, you know, like trying to compete with him. I don't think my other kids handled it quite the same, and I probably didn't validate that enough with them, you know, to be honest, because I know they struggle with it, but I was sort of like, what? Like, just go out and do it, you know, like, show them who you are, you know, like, they know, you know, and it was sort of probably a mistake on my part, but because I like really thrived on it, and I was excited to go out there and show them. And yeah, look, not to be arrogant, but I used to think, like, I've got Steve Rogers' genes in me. This is what I used to think as a kid. Like, he's like the best player in the world. Like, I've got him in me. Like, none of these kids have got that. And that's how I would think. And I would go out and play and, you know, try to put on my best performance every time I went out and played. And I took a lot of pride in it. I didn't want to let Dad down. I didn't want to let myself down. And I wanted to perform at a high level all the time.
You talked about in your book about when you're the ball boy, the guy that runs the sand out, and seeing your father get injured. And I tell you now, it made me, I got a bit teary when I read it because I could picture you as a kid and what had happened to your father. No son wants to see that happen to his father.
No, it was probably one of the more harrowing experiences in my life because it happened right in front of me. Like, you know, literally, I was a ball boy on the sideline.
So Bell how old are you? Around,
I was probably six,
right.
Seven, mate.
Gee whiz.
And just a massive swing and arm by a fellow by the name of Mark Bugden, and just smashed my dad's jaw. And he stayed down, but his back was to me. And I was sort of like just sitting there watching the play unfold. The play went on and he didn't move. And then the game got stopped and they went out there. And Dad, I remember him picking Dad up and Dad just looking back and looking for the guy that actually hit him. But his jaw was like almost down because it smashed both the sort of hinges, so it was just sort of like the skin holding his jaw in place. Blood was pouring out of his mouth, and his jaw was, he couldn't shut his mouth, so his jaw was just open. And
you were six.
And I remember, yeah, I think I was six. Maybe it was 82, 83. I might have been eight.
Right.
Six to eight. Yeah. Very young. And I still remember probably one of the more daunting, or one of the more just ridiculous things that happened. And so I remember my brother behind, like, hysterical in the crowd because he could see what had happened. And he was sitting with my mum, and my mum's trying to control him because he's a few years older than me. He's trying to climb over the barricades to get to Dad. But I was sort of out on the show. You know, like, everybody was around me was, I didn't know what to think. And then this photographer came running over to me and he's like, oh, you're Steve's son, aren't you? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, oh, let's get a photo. You know, and I'm like, and as a, you know, a 7-8-year-old kid, I didn't know I could say no. I just thought I have to do this because I'm in Cronulla uniform and I'm the ball boy. So I remember he got me leaning on the bucket and the bucket was real flimsy and I couldn't really lean on the bucket. I still remember it, like, so vividly. But there, I didn't know what to do. Whether I should go into the dressing room and see Dad or not. And I was really scared to go in there because I was worried about what I'd see, to be honest. And it's a Belmore sports ground, which is just, you know, old concrete stand. And I remember creeping through these halls to get to the to where Dad was, and just a muffled sound of the crowd above me, and there was no one in there because the game was on. And I crept in. I got to like the opening of the dressing room, and I just sort of stuck my head in, and Dad was just sitting on this bench on his own. And I'm like, why is he on his own, you know? And I was too scared to go in there. So I sort of, and Dad just saw me peek around the corner, and he waved me over and just told me to jump up on the strapping bench next to him and just hug me. Sort of, that's sort of when I broke down in tears, you know, just seeing my dad suffer like that. Within like a couple of minutes, the team doctor, Peter Malouris, he was my team doctor at Cronulla. He'd been there for years, and he actually delivered my brother and myself. So
of course he did.
He's been a very close family friend, and he sort of gave me a hug and told me Dad was going to be all right and settled me down a bit. But it was, it's sort of one of those things that can sort of send you one way or the other when you see something like that. It was so dramatic. Do I want to play or not? But I never really had... It never really deterred me from wanting to do it. Sort of probably spurred me on more than anything to think that, you know, they had to do that to get my dad off the field, you know, because he's so good. And that was, you know, basically a game plan that was found out later, that they wanted to get Dad off the field because he's so damaging, and it worked.
Back to Matt in a moment. Next up on the show, the voice of cricket, Harsha Bogle, a man with brilliant stories, 9 million Twitter followers, and the skill to always say the right thing at the right time. Harsha is the man. Sachin Tendulkar, you called his last moments in Test cricket, which we'll get to in a moment, but I haven't seen him in India. I've been told stories by Gilly or Ricky or Brett Lee about the size of the man, but I still don't think I get a grasp for the scale of the love for Sachin in India.
I think at that level, him or Alara, even a Ponting, they just see the game very differently. And in your conversations with him, he would recall something that happened 10 years ago. Not just how a batsman got out, but what the field was, where the fielder had just moved, why he played that shot, what the bounce was. He just remembered everything. But if you messaged him, if I messaged him today, I'll get a reply saying, how are you? And I had this tradition, on his birthday, wherever he was, I'd send him a fax message. Fax had come back. send him a fax message. But yeah, we got to know each other. And so when that retirement thing came, everybody in India was crying. Everybody in India. And that is when you realized what he meant to India. So Tendulkar wasn't a cricketer. Tendulkar was the awareness that an Indian could be the best. And so he gave everybody hope and confidence, saying that if Tendulkar can be the best, we too could be, maybe.
That is Harsha Bogle next up on the podcast. Let's get back to Matt. So at what stage for you, often people at this point try and be modest as athletes, but they've obviously come on the show, they've achieved a lot. At what stage did it strike you as a teenager that, okay, maybe I could actually follow in my dad's footsteps and become a professional footballer, get paid to play a game?
Went through a couple of phases, I must say. Like when I was 12, I made the under-12 Queensland side, and from that point, I really wanted to take it on. I remember asking Dad, can I make money playing rugby league? And he told me I could. He said, you can make money doing anything if you're best at it.
Yes.
And I'm like, all right, cool. Oh, I'm gonna do it. And then my mum and dad bought the pub at Lennox Head with some business partners, and we moved down there. And I just went off, spiraled out of control of my life. My mum and dad were running the pub, and I was sort of left to my own devices with my brother, and just stopped going to school and surfed every day. Didn't play footy for a whole year. Started smoking drugs and just all sorts of things that no 13-year-old should be doing. And ended up in a little bit of trouble with the law, and I was close to being sent to juvenile detention. And then my dad said to the magistrate that I can send him to boarding school if that suffice. And fortunately, the magistrate of the court said, yep, he's got to go for 2 years, and I got sent to boarding school, to the Southport school, and that changed my life. That's where the penny dropped, and I'm like, yeah, I'm doing this.
Was it hard early doors? Leaving you, like, you're leaving Lennox, you got that magnificent right-hand point break outside the front door.
I loved it. I served every day. Like, I literally would take my board to school, telling my mum, I've got surfing for a subject at school. So like I just told her I had it every day. So, man, I'd go, get off the bus at North Wall, to surf, I think at North Wall, we'd paddle over to South Wall, Bow, and I'd surf all day, get on the bus, come home. And I wagged a whole term of school, which didn't go down well with my family, with mum and dad. But they were so busy, you know, and thought that we were doing all right, but I really wasn't. And, it was tough. It was really tough because from living that life I was living, you know, surfing some of the best breaks in the world every day of my life, to then being sent to boarding school where I couldn't get out and even go for a surf, it was tough. And I really didn't handle it very well for the first few months. But once the footy season started, I started playing rugby at the school. That's where I started my rugby union career, and fell in love with it, and, you know, made some rep sides. And I just sort of knew, like, when I got to that point, and I kept making rep sides as a kid, I wasn't always the best player, though. There were always kids ahead of me. In every rep side I made, I think, you know, I was on the bench or I was a kid, because I was always really small. I was a really late developer, so I was a real small kid, and there were always bigger kids that were my age and would get the jump over me in positions and stuff. But the next year, I would grow a bit, and I'd be better than that. I knew I was a better player than that person, but I just wasn't as big. And that matters in some positions. And ended up, just by the time I got to year 12, I just knew that, you know, I'm going to make a career out of this. And it sort of, you know, I loved playing rugby, and I wanted to stay in rugby, but rugby at the time wasn't professional. So when you've got a carrot dangled in front of you of like, yeah, we'll try and find you a job, and you can come play for us, or we'll pay you this and come and play here.
And you enter rugby league at the Super League time. The rugby league was being split. There was money being thrown left, right and centre. So all of a sudden, you know, I think you wrote in your book, your dad negotiated a contract for you for, I don't know, was it 350 grand a year?
250 grand. I was on a week, like 2 weeks earlier, I was on 40 grand.
Wow.
And did a deal. I negotiated a deal myself, which, you know, I was 18 years old, and I got pulled into a room with News Limited boss Ken Cowley and our football manager on my own.
At 18. And to be fair to say, you'd wagged a few years of school as well, so your maths might not have been that sharp.
No. So I ended up, like, no lie, like, I go in there and, like, Ken Cowley, so I say, the Super League's going to happen, blah, 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 and... Like, this was after a game in WA, and my mum and dad were living in Darwin at the time, and I couldn't get onto them. So I'm like, I'm trying to ring dad to say, what do I do here? But dad was out, you know, partying with his mates or whatever, so I couldn't get onto him and mum. And I ended up in this room, like I said, with probably, you know, like Rupert Murdoch's right-hand man and probably the shrewdest negotiator in sport, Shane Richardson, and an 18-year-old me. And it was pretty easy negotiation for them. They said, here's 100 grand, 120 grand, 140 grand for the next 3 years. And if you sign it right now, we'll give you this $25,000 check.
And you're on 40 grand at the time?
I was on 40 grand at the time. So as if I'm not going to say yes to that.
It's a 300% pay rise.
Oh, mate, it's crazy. So 25 grand on the spot too. Like,
if you sign it there and then?
If I sign it now, they said, but if you don't sign tonight, the deal is still on the table tomorrow, but you just won't get this. That was more than half of what I was on for the year. So I just signed. And they put us in a room, though. Like, I had about half a dozen beers before I got in there, and I was a lightweight, so I was half cut. I'm like, seeing double. I'm like, right, where do I sign? Anyway, we ended up going and sitting down with... it was a bit of a long story to it. It's all in the book, but, yeah, it was quite funny, because Dad wanted me to go back and meet with the ARL because he was pissed off with Super League. The way that they handled that situation and the Sharks in particular, not communicating with my dad, given his stature at the Sharks. Anyway, I ended up sitting down with John Reba. He was an old teammate of Dad's, who was the boss of Super League. Dad rang him and just said, mate, my son's not playing in Super League under the current circumstances. He was drunk when you signed him. It was a ridiculous setup. And he's like, righto, mate, let's just have dinner. So I go into dinner with John Rebo, my dad, Ken Cowley's there as well, and a guy named Peter Mulholland, who just recently passed, rest his soul, lovely man. And yeah, we're just sitting there and Reeve says to Dad, righto, Sludge, who my dad's nickname, they were teammates. He goes, well, let's get the elephant out of the room so we can enjoy a good meal. What do you want? And he goes, $2.50 a year. He goes, righto. Look at Cowley. Cowley goes, yep. He goes, yep, we can do that. He goes, righto, can we enjoy dinner now? the funny thing was is that we walk out of the restaurant and Dad's like pissed off. And I'm like, I'm stoked, man. I'm just going from 40 grand to 250 grand in like 2 weeks. And Dad's like pissed. I'm like, what's up? He goes, mate, I could have asked for 500. They would have given us and they would have given us anything. I'd played like four first-grade games at that time, you know. Like, but I guess that, you know, Super League, they were chasing players, you know. They needed to, and mate, we went back and played the NRL, but when you look at like who won the war, like Super League won the war, like they got everything they wanted. They got the TV rights, they got, you know, they got it all. And you know, they had to shelf a couple of teams like Adelaide and WA. They didn't care. They wanted TV rights. They didn't care about rugby league in Adelaide or WA. No. They cared about TV being on Foxtel.
Well, it's similar.
Rugby being on Foxtel.
It's similar to what happened with World Series. In fact, it's similar, Matty, to what's happening with LIV, with the golf now.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
And the money they're being paid.
And I'll tell you who benefits from it. Everybody.
Yeah.
Because the players get better playing conditions. The viewers get better content or more content. Everyone benefits. Yep. And, you know, there's people that, you know, and with the LIV Golf thing, I'm sort of like, I love it. I'm like, good.
No, me
let's
too.
Bring some change. You know, there's been no, I'm just right off on a tangent. You know, I'm a golf tragic, right? So we've got no, we don't get any of the big international stars to Australia anymore because the USPGA just took it over and extended their season and no one comes back. Now we might get some world-class golf here on our shores, which is pretty exciting. And it gives a lot of other pros more opportunity to play on different tours, which is cool.
So how did you handle, and what did you learn about yourself, Matty, when you became a big-time rugby league star where everybody knew your name, every door was open to you, you can't really do anything wrong because people will praise you anyway? As a young man, all of a sudden earning a lot of money, and so many athletes go through this, what did you learn about yourself?
On the Sharks end of the ground, they win the scrum and they find Paul Medlaw.
I learned that I had a lot more friends than I thought. You know, a lot of people come out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
You know, those people that, oh, I had a few teachers at school that, you know, would just give it to me and just tell me that I'm not going to make it and stuff. I remember going back there and they, all of a sudden they want to be in documentary, we're shooting, and, you know, they were telling me that, you know, they were the driving force, that was the thing that drove me. I'm like, oh, just shake my head, you know. Had some amazing people in my corner through my school life as well. I won't put crap on all the teachers, but there were certainly a few that got my eye. But what I learned, I guess, you know, once you've made it or perceived to have made it, you know, or you're playing at that top level, what I learned is that, you know, you got to keep working just as hard, otherwise you're not going to stay there. And I've always been one to, I've never been the biggest, I've never been the strongest, but I've always thought I could be the fittest. And I always worked really hard, spent a lot of time in the gym, did a lot of the little things that made me able to compete in such a physical game with such a small frame for so long. I was just really disciplined in that sense. I think I was obsessed, that's what I realised. Like, and I think to succeed at the top level, you've got to be. Obsession, like, there are so many kids that want it, right? Like, and there's so many kids that have talent, but unless you're obsessed, you're not going to make it. Like, it literally has to own you. And that was me, you know, it owned me. Like, nothing else came before what I had to do to play. Nothing, ever. If I had to train and there was a party, or if there, you know, people were going away, but I had sessions to do, or, you know, whatever. Like, nothing ever, ever came first other than, you know, my football career, before it started and when it started. And I think that's why it worked for me, you know. Like, I see so many kids with so much talent that don't make it. They're just not obsessed with it.
Yeah.
They have that opinion of, oh, it'd be nice to play in the NRL. Oh, it'd be nice to play in the AFL. It'd be nice to be an Australian cricketer. Well, yeah, of course it would be nice. But unless it owns you and you live it and breathe it every single day, they're going to do anything. You're going to be watching it.
So this is you, right? You're obsessed and you're succeeding. I had, I'm blessed to have a couple of children. I had my daughter at age 36 and it was like, wow, there's a lot more going on here than I ever anticipated, having a first child at age 36 and I was established and had a good job and a beautiful partner and a house and stuff. You became a father at 20 in the midst of this rugby league maelstrom. How did that affect you? How did that change you? And how did you deal with what we would now call a young parent?
Well, it was good for me. It just made me realise this isn't just about me now. I can't afford to get it wrong. And slowed me down, you know. Like I was not an angel. I say I was obsessed. I certainly wasn't an angel. Like I wasn't like a, you know, Tom Brady who has avocado oil and no dairy. You know, like
you weren't on the avocado oil.
I was pretty wild, you know. Like I knew when it was time to work, I worked, you know. Like I certainly let my hair down, and but I never missed sessions, or I always backed up. And having Jack when, you know, at 20 years old, you know, my mum and dad had three kids by 21. You know,
yes.
I had, you know, my brother at 18, myself at 20, my sister at 21. But that was just sort of what, I thought that was the way it's done. I have kids early, you know, like I wanted to have kids early. It just made me focus. Created another monster inside me, you know, like to fuel, you know, like it just gave me more fuel to continue on the path.
That is the end of Matt Rogers Part A. Get your ears around Part B.